Welcome to another fun episode of Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 19, recorded on March 22nd, 2018. We talk about all the geekiest stuff, the news that I can drum up on a weekly basis in the photography industry. And we've got some pretty fun stuff that kind of has a forward-thinking approach in this episode. And I couldn't be more honored to have as my guest, as my co-pilot for this episode, Mr. Frederick Van Johnson. How you doing, Frederick?
I'm doing great, Don Komarechka. Thanks for having me on. It feels comfortable to be a co-pilot every now and then. So thanks for having me on.
No, I appreciate it. And we go way back. I think the reason why I bought the microphone that I'm talking on right now is you agreed to interview me for an episode of This Week in Photo on snowflake photography way back in the earlier days of TWIP, where you attack a photographer interview at the end of the conversation.
Yeah.
And that's where I got started in all this. So it's because of you that I am here, and I can't thank you enough for that privilege and the opportunity to kind of play it back and forth now to have you on a show that I'm doing.
Yeah. And you are 100% welcome, and though I want to take credit for that, I think you're probably on the path to doing this anyway, because you're as your audience probably knows, a highly intelligent person. Our paths happen to cross at the right time. But I have a suspicion you would be doing this with or without me having interviewed you on TWIP.
Well, yes, but you did give me that big initial push.
Yeah.
And it's great to have this back and forth conversation. And I think I'm going to be on an upcoming episode of This Week in Photo, but we'll save that until the end when we're talking about stuff.
Yeah, let's talk about that later.
Yeah. What's new and exciting for you? I know that the This Week in Photo network has just been reborn into something wonderful.
Yeah, it's exciting. So, the TWIP audience will know this, but I took a hiatus from This Week in Photo for a lot of reasons, which I go into in some of the previous episodes of This Week in Photo, so I won't bore you with them now, but on the return, one of my decisions and kind of ideas to kind of keep the juices flowing on This Week in Photo and keep it relevant was to introduce the concept of live streaming. And there was a lot of reasons behind that. One of the main reasons was I wanted to have the ability to pre-schedule shows and pre-promote those shows, which I can do when you live stream, because you can just, build them out for the year if you want to and schedule guests and all that stuff. And the old This Week in Photo was more of a seat of your pants kind of scramble for guests every week. And sometimes the guests didn't match the topics and, it was up to me to kind of be the glue to bring it all together and make it be cohesive. Now we can be a much tighter show. I can promote it. And to be honest with you, it allows me to scratch the geekery itch in me with regard to this live streaming stuff, because it is deceptively complex when you get into it. It's simple because you can stream from your phone if you want to. But if you want to do kind of a higher level production, it becomes, it can be as complex as you want it to be. So
if you want to make it easy on your end to just kind of switch between different views and cameras and guide the conversation just by your fingertips, like you're playing a piano almost.
Exactly.
But to make that happen, you've got like a wire jungle and all these mixers and mix minus going to this place and software.
No. And that was, I'm glad you brought that up, because my friend Joseph Lanasky, also known as Photo Joseph, has a really popular YouTube channel, and he and I go way back. We used to actually work at Apple together, and he and I, he's like got both feet up to the neck into live streaming, and he's the uber geek in terms of this stuff. And so he's been my sort of source of inspiration and, frankly, knowledge. I've been, in the early days of me getting the stuff set up, I was bugging him every day, what about this? How do I do that? But his studio, and he actually has a rented space where he's got his studio set up and cameras hanging from this thing and lights hanging from the ceiling, all that, the real deal. And I honestly didn't want that. I didn't want kind of a Leo Laporte kind of studio. Leo has a brick and mortar studio. It's fantastic, but he could easily just flip a switch and become a television studio, right? I didn't want that. I'm in a spare bedroom in my house, and I wanted it to feel like a room with a computer in it and some lights, you know. I wanted it to be elegant. My house is very kind of dialed in, right? And I wanted it, I didn't want a room full of junk and wires and this, and I got to plug this in and, you know, all that stuff whenever I want to do a show. So that was part of my, that was part of the equation that I was solving for, was to, how do I do a repeatable live stream video, make it look professional, have it be bulletproof so I can not focus on the geekery of all this stuff and focus on the content every week and engaging with the guests, and have it all work every single time, but still look cool. And that's what I built. So, and it, it's,
yeah. And I like Leo's studio where he's got his office and he records some podcast there. I'm an avid listener of Security Now and a few others. And it's just, it's more of like a talking head kind of environment, but it doesn't need to be more than that. That's engaging enough to see expression and to carry on a conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I love this stuff. It's addicting, as you know. I mean, the podcasting part of it, notwithstanding, that's one part of it. I mean, we did what, 500 plus episodes as a podcast video Google Hangout thing. And now I feel like the evolution is into live. Part of that live evolution, you know, all the geek talk about hardware and getting everything in configuration. If you take that out of it, one of the main benefits of going live and doing a live stream that's at the same time every week is the community engagement and being able to bring the community via the chat room into the show itself. There's something magical about that, of like being able to watch people discuss and you know, have side conversations about the topics that you're discussing on the show and bring them into the show. Like yesterday, you were on TWIP 511 as we recorded.
I'll show up in the peanut gallery and hassle you once in a while.
Yeah, it's great, right? I can say, hey, look, Don Komareska's in the chat room, and you know, you had substantive comments that we made that we didn't even think of, and those got incorporated into the show. So I think the bringing the masses into the show and giving them the opportunity to engage with us enhances the show even further, which is what we weren't able to do before. The only interaction we had before on the show was through social media or blog comments. Now we can do it live, and it all seems to be working. So knock on wood.
Yeah, well, you know, more power to you for getting it all sorted out and, you know, having very few technical difficulties along the way. You know, you had a few. I expected anybody trying to do something like that is going to, you know, fumble a little bit. But there's, it seems like it's all smoothed out now.
Yeah, and, well, that's, yeah, you don't look how the sausage is made. So there's the road to having a smooth live stream is fraught with, you know, landmines and you know, sand pits and quicksand and all that stuff. But once you get there, and I think it's a rite of passage for people as they do this stuff. I'm sure when you started your podcast, there's like these, it's not like big problems. There's just a million little problems that you need to solve. And, but once you solve them, you got it and you move on to the next thing. Each live stream I do, I mean, even podcasts, each production I do, I learn something. There's always one little nugget I learn about, oh, this thing, you know, this piece of gear is flaky, so I need to unplug it and plug it back in before I start, or else it'll lose connection. You know, it's little things like that that you learn that you won't know until you actually dive in and do it. You can read about it, watch YouTube videos all day and ask people questions, but until you throw yourself into Thunderdome, it's not going to work.
No. And yeah, you have to enjoy the tinkering. You have to enjoy that problem solving process. And that's what I do with a lot of my photography. I'll sit in my studio and tinker for 4 hours. Yeah. I don't know necessarily what I'm going to come up with. I have an initial idea and initial problems to solve. And for every problem that I solve, I get a new idea, you know, and I might not branch off into those ideas right that in that moment, but it kind of floats around in my head to what the possibilities are to move forward with.
Yeah.
And that kind of is an interesting segue to one of our first stories here, because, you know, that involves experimenting and testing the waters and seeing what works and what doesn't. And Canon is currently doing that right now. For better or worse, this is a story from photographyblog.com about some of the prototype equipment that Canon currently has on display at the Photography Show 2018. Now, Frederick, I know you've gone through this this post and you've seen some of the images of these prototypes here. I'll just give a quick summary. One is a camera that is with whatever artificial intelligence algorithms will change its orientation. It's motorized in this little webcam like looks like a bobblehead, or Matryoshka dolls, those little Russian stacking dolls, and. And it's got a camera on it that you can either wear around your neck, which looks really I mean, I'm geeky, but that takes it to a whole new level. You can mount it to the top of your camera, and it looks like one of those little Russian dolls sitting in your hot shoe on the top of your... It just seems weird. Yeah. And I'm not sure if there's a market for it. But what's a little bit more interesting is Canon had this this prototype of a equivalent of 100 to 400 millimeter telephoto lens for a smartphone that wasn't actually attached to your smartphone. It was a separate device controlled wirelessly by your smartphone. And I think that one has a little bit more merit. But what do you think about these experiments from Canon here, Frederick?
Well, bravo to Canon for experimenting, right? Because I think the industry needs more experimentation. Most of this stuff, let's be honest, most of this stuff is going to fail, right? Because like you said, you hit it right on the head. It's they're a disease or a cure in search of a disease, right? So you're building this stuff kind of on spec and doing the whole field of dreams. If you build it, they will buy it mindset. And for things like this, you know, starting with that 360 degree camera, I think it depends on the market that you're going for and what people are trying to do. Like if you're trying to solve for a mass market, it's not going to work, in my opinion. If you're trying to solve for a particular use case, like you're saying, if Canon's saying, you know, we're going to build these 360 degree cameras and we're going to market them to educators and photographers so that they can, you know, record or stream or whatever their training classes to people, and people can then look around in 360 as, you know, and see what the photographer sees from the photographer's POV. That's one thing. But for your average consumer, probably not. I mean, even 360 degree video and stills right now are very niche, right? It may take off, it may not, but it's still very niche. So I don't see, you know, again, bravo to Canon for innovating, but I don't see things like this taking off. That the external lens, that's something else completely, because that reminds me of the DxO, you know, the DxO camera?
The DxO-1.
Yeah, the DxO-1. I have one of those, and it's, you know, I love it. It's great when I use it, but it produces really good imagery, but at the same time, it's not the path of least resistance to me taking images, right? My iPhone 10 is the path of least resistance. Hitting a button, taking a picture, and throwing it back in my pocket. And if there are any more hurdles between me and taking an image than that, I'll grab a proper camera and shoot with a proper camera.
Exactly. I mean, there could be use cases for this camera, especially because it's remote controlled. Maybe you could like put it up in a tree somewhere to overlook some birds at a distance and kind of get like a view of a bird's nest. Mm-hmm. But there's already equipment to do that. There's action cameras and tons of other gear. If you want to do telephoto work, I don't think anybody is looking for a product like this.
Right.
And I think that's where the problem is, because if you're not looking for something that is a niche, then it's just going to be completely passed over. And it's kind of sad because they've got like four or five different prototypes. They've done them in different colors and everything. There's a lot of research and development money and time and effort put into this.
Yeah.
And as a product itself, I don't know if it's going to go anywhere, but maybe it will evolve into other technology, because when a company develops tech like this, there's a lot of patents and there's a lot of intellectual property that they develop as a part of creating that. Mm-hmm. And while it might not function as a standalone product right now, it does kind of hedge their bets a little bit, because mm-hmm. as technology continues to move forward and maybe the industry and what the industry wants out of a product evolves, then they've already done some of that legwork and they've got the foundation in terms of patents and everything else to build up on from there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, honestly, I wish Canon would maybe take a little bit of that R&D budget and throw it over to their mirrorless efforts.
Rumors are abound that they have done just that. We just don't have anything come to fruition yet. Yeah. So
I've been hearing that rumor for 3 years, Don. So.
I know. But even you look at what Nikon did with their Key Mission, action cam lineup of hardware. And I think it actually looks kind of neat. It's an interesting product, but it's too late to the market that's already saturated for a product that, you know, if you've got like a GoPro from any of the last, say, three generations, it's probably good enough. Yeah. Or a product of a similar class. You don't need to go out and buy the latest and greatest. Yeah. So when you enter into a market that is all the players are already established, and the product cycles are so long that you can't just jump in and say, hey, you know, we're going to steal the market. Mm-hmm. Nikon's had issues with that, with their action cameras. And I worry that Canon and Nikon are going to come up against that same wall when they finally put a good foot forward into the mirrorless market.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, tell that is a cautionary tale that they should have learned from, let's say, GoPro and the Karma experiment. Let's
call it that. Call it an experiment,
The Karma drone experiment, and how, you know, entering into an already mature market with players that are highly competent doesn't always end well, you know. And then going back to that Key Mission 360, I bought one of those. I was excited. I was waiting for it because, you know, mainly because I wanted to learn about 360 video. I wanted to play with it. And I had a 360, the Insta360, which is smaller and lower resolution. And then Nikon is coming out with this beast of a 360 camera that will shoot 4K and all this other stuff. So I picked one up. Man, I got to tell you, I couldn't even get that thing synced to my phone. I'm a technical person. I could not. Going through their instructions 30 times, literally verbatim, nothing. And then getting online, you know, as we do, getting online and trying to figure out, well, maybe I should have stood on one foot and hold one eye closed while I'm trying to sync. Maybe that would do it, you know. And it was just a litany of people that were having the same issues. So I returned it. It's literally the first camera that I've ever returned was that thing, because I just could not get it to work. I never took one photo with it. I never...
That's too bad. Yeah. I mean, because they had a promising, platform here, but it boils down to whether or not it's useful and intuitive. And right out of the gates, if you don't hit the ground running, if you stumble and fall over and try to pick yourself up, your market has already moved on.
Yeah.
So it's unfortunate, but hey, there's always room to grow in the photography market. Innovation is everywhere around us. And so, you know, when you see these companies make these experiments, whether they are a success or a failure at the end of it, the experimentation should be applauded at the very least.
Absolutely.
Now, I want to go on to the next story here, which I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on, but I figured we could both kind of, share some experience with it, because it has to do with helicopters and aerial photography. And I know that you've had some experience in the past, probably in your military days, of flying in aircraft, and you were a photographer there as well.
Yeah.
There was a catastrophic crash recently, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of, where an AS-350, also called an A-STAR helicopter, crashed into the water just off the coast of New York City, and the pilot survived, but all of the passengers were trapped inside and did not survive that. So the FAA has basically ruled, at least right now, that you can't take the doors off of a helicopter for a leisurely photographic flight anymore. And it's kind of interesting, because I've flown in this exact same model of helicopter over the Toronto harborfront in the air. And one of my most famous photographs is taken with a fisheye lens from that perspective. Now, if you've got a fisheye lens, that's 180-degree field of view. If I'm not removing the camera from the body of the helicopter, then the helicopter's in the frame. Yeah. So I have to be physically removed, or at least part of me. I was able to get my hands and, my head and my upper shoulders out of a window that was specifically designed into this particular plane. And I'm not sure if it's an option on all of them, but this one was outfitted with that specifically for photography, so that you're not shooting through glass and you've got the ability, with a door still on the plane, to make some great images, without having any barrier between you and the landscape around you. Yeah. So if that's the case, then and this whole doors off flight is more of a thrill ride, right? Like it's unnecessary in order to get the good photograph. So if you're dismayed that, hey, you're not going to get that great shot, it's still possible. It's not going away, but you're not going to have your feet dangling out of the helicopter, which personally I would never want to do anyways. So Frederick, what is your experience with aerial photography and your time in helicopters?
Yeah, I like this story, Don. This is really, really interesting. I don't like it because of the tragedy, obviously, but this is interesting because it shines a light on where the industry is going in a lot of ways. The And you're right. Yeah, I was in the United States Air Force as a combat photojournalist, and we would fly out of UH-1 in helicopters all the time. In fact, we had to literally fly just about every week in order to stay aerial qualified, because you had to get a certain number of hours in the air in order to keep your wings, right? So we would jump right in the back of planes with pilots that were flying around to keep their wings, right? So we were the photographers, so we would routinely fly with doors open, not doors off, but doors, because the doors would slide back, right? Mm-hmm. And you'd just lock them back, and we would fly with the doors open. I remember flying all the way from Vandenberg Air Force Base, which is an Air Force base which is on the coast of California, about an hour north of Santa Barbara. It's about 30 to 40 miles of untouched military protected coastline. Beautiful. So we would fly from there. Yeah. Yeah. It's a, you know, if you look at a map of California, you see a piece of it that kind of juts out into the ocean a little bit. That's Vandenberg Air Force Base. That's where they launch the Titan space launch vehicles and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, so we would fly for rocket launches and all kinds of things and document them for the Air Force. You know, everything's classified, obviously, but we would document everything. And we would occasionally, just to get hours, fly up, doors open, up the coast. We flew up one time all the way up to the Golden Gate Bridge, flew around it a couple times, and then flew back home, and then, you know, went and had lunch after that.
I'm envious.
Yeah, it's fun, you know, and seeing all the nude beaches on the California coast as you fly. Not as spectacular as you might think. Let's see that. But flying doors open was great. I mean, we would fly doors open, and we would have a harness on us, and you would attach it to a hook on the floor, you know, on the floor of the aircraft, so that if something happened or the aircraft had to suddenly do some maneuver, you wouldn't fly out of the aircraft. You know, you're attached.
Yeah, you're attached in a harness. And I think the issue here is that if you're inexperienced with this kind of equipment, a lot of these people might be going into one of these aircrafts for the first time. Mm-hmm. Those harnesses can be difficult to get into and out of.
Yeah.
And if you are panicked in, you know, a drowning helicopter, getting yourself free from that equipment, I think that was the big issue.
Yes.
And so while it would keep you safe in the air, come to a ground emergency where you have to exit the vehicle quickly. The pilot got out,
yeah,
but the five occupants were unable to.
Yeah,
and there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a solution
in the military.
In
the military, your solution is practice. So we would practice egress out of the aircraft, you know, many, many, many times in case of an emergency like that. If you're a tourist, you know, I mean, you might have an hour safety briefing or less, you know, but you're not having days and days of practicing getting out of the aircraft. But the way I look at the story, and I think of it in terms of the impact on the industry, is like you were saying, to get this kind of shot, you don't necessarily need to have doors open. And I would argue you don't even necessarily these days need to be in a helicopter, right? Because we have we have drones now that you can get similar shots, aircraft protected airspace notwithstanding.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I saw a story of a guy that flew his drone up to 30,000 feet.
Yeah.
That's cruising altitude for a lot of aircraft. And that's dumb.
That's dumb.
Especially, you never know where a flight path is going to be, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So, but we have so many more options to get this kind of an image.
Yeah.
And there are smaller helicopters too. I remember we were going to photograph a building development, me and a colleague of mine who is an aerial photographer. That's his core business. And he had a free seat in a helicopter. And whenever he does, you know, I'm more than happy to take that seat. But we would fly to the location. We put ourselves down on the ground nearby, took the doors off of the aircraft then, so that we could get the best shots possible, took our shots, landed again, put the doors back on, and we went home.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you don't want, if you don't have to, if there is any way to avoid that kind of a risk, then yeah, take it.
Yeah.
You know, use a sliding window, or if you're after the thrill, and yeah, there's tons of thrill seekers out there that want to do this sort of stuff. If that is the thrill that you're after, then, you know, train, like mm-hmm. you said, you know, practice, you know, you can't just jump in and expect perfect results if something goes wrong, because you have to know it sort of like the back of your hand, almost like it's an instinctual thing.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, muscle memory and all that stuff. Anyhow, I figured you'd be a good person to talk about that on the show.
Oh, so I could talk about that forever.
Conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's fun, and you know, I'm envious of those stories. Yeah. Something that I'm not envious of, though, is when data disappears on people. Oh. And I found this story from F-Stoppers from Alex Cook, and he says basically his hard drive failed. Thankfully, it was part of a RAID array that had a backup, but you know, how many times have you just like, I've actually woken up from a nightmare where, you know, somebody broke into my house and stole everything. And yes, my insurance can pay for replacing stuff, but they can't replace my images. And thankfully that was a dream. I panic, I run downstairs. Whew, okay. Everything is still in place because you know, what happens when data disappears and backup strategy. The point of this conversation is what do you do to back up your images? Frederick, I know you've got a strategy for this in place. What is it?
Yeah, well, just like everything else, it's ever evolving, right? And my friend Alex Lindsay used to say that data does not exist if it is not replicated in three places, right? So you basically expect to lose it. And then the other saying goes, is from the days when I had a motorcycle, was there on the motorcycle, it goes, there are people that have fallen off of their motorcycles or had motorcycle accidents and people that will. There's only two kinds of people. And the same goes for data loss. There's people that will lose data and people that have already lost data. So keeping that in mind, I'm in a constant state of yellow alert regarding losing stuff. So currently, and after speaking with a friend of mine, Troy Miller, my system's going to change and I'll tell you what's going to change too. But currently I have two Drobos. And one is a mirror of the other. And then, you know, everything is synced up to crash plan, right? So, there are giant holes in the strategy, but, you know, that's the way it works. So, everything goes, basically, my flow is, if I'm working on a project right now, it's on my local computer. I'm on an iMac, a 5K iMac. So, it's on the local computer. I have a fast external SSD drive that I plug into it for video editing and that sort of thing. So I can migrate to and from this computer to a MacBook Pro easily. But everything basically ends up on drive one, the Drobo one. At night, a process runs that copies everything on drive one over to drive two. So, and these are RAIDs anyway. So I feel like I'm triply protected there. I'm not protected from catastrophic physical damage, like a boulder rolls over my house or thieves come in and steal everything or it burns down or something like that, right?
And that's where your offsite,
that's where the offsite
strategy comes in.
That's where the offsite comes in. But I know that there have been lots of issues with Drobos, right? I used to work at that company many years ago, and they're a completely different company now, but online, if you do some research, you know that there have been issues with Drobo, both in terms of the reliability of the units, the proprietary RAID system that they use, that's called Beyond RAID, and then the customer support, frankly, has left a lot of people wanting. So where I'm going to move to, probably, hopefully by mid-year or so, is to something similar to what you have. I believe you're using a Synology system.
I do. I've got one of their monster units that has 12 bays.
Oh, geez, no. And I'm not going there.
Well, see, the reason why is I'm not using them all right now. But if I want to upgrade my storage, and I can throw in another drive, I don't have to start replacing anything. I've got room to just expand and expand and expand. The fun thing about the Synology is it's connected via the network. So, I mean, I have it air-gapped, so it's just connected only to the one computer that I use for editing. It doesn't need to be internet connected, at least not right now. Maybe if I'm traveling for a bit, I can just, you know, rearrange the wires on that. It's got an upgrade option for a 10 gigabit Ethernet. So, and I put one in my computer. So it's really, really fast compared to what I might have gotten from other devices. The only downside from that is if I was using Carbonite as a backup service, and they were really great. I had no problems with them when I had a Drobo, because the Drobo was a directly attached device via USB 3, right? So it was like a portable hard drive. And Carbonite allows unlimited backup. It was, I forget exactly what tier it was, but it was above their basic tier. And it included these direct attached storage devices. I'm sure they didn't count on me having like 14 terabytes on one device, yes. Which was my Drobo, they were losing money on my subscription to their service because of the amount of storage that I was uploading. But hey, I was winning.
You were the edge case. Having, you were, you were their worst case. Nightmare case.
But now that I've got my my network attached storage device, that no longer qualifies for the same plan, and there's no unmetered backup, no unlimited storage options for a network attached device. However, you can configure a lot of these Synology devices to operate in iSCSI mode, which SCSI SCSI is. For those that aren't familiar, it was traditionally used in more enterprise hard drive configurations and would allow a lot of hard drives to be attached onto the same bus at the same time. Daisy chain. It's evolved quite significantly. And iSCSI, from what I understand, is a it's using the same protocol and the same connection, even though the actual underlying tech, the hardware, is different. But because it's using that same protocol, it can appear as a direct attached device. Ooh. But I didn't do that to start off with. And so now you can't just convert to that. I would have to offload my data somewhere else, redo the configuration of the hardware, and then put it all back on. So I'm kind of stuck where I am right now. And that's a big problem because of the amount of data I have. I can't use a crash plan or a Carbonite without spending like $3,000 or $4,000 a year just for the storage of that data offsite. Yeah. So I've come up with a few novel ideas. Number one, I've got a safety deposit box with a hard drive on it that has all of my business documents, every edited photo that I've ever produced, because the bulk of the data on my Synology is either raw video files or unedited raw files that I don't necessarily need anymore, but I keep them all. Mm-hmm. So I update that maybe every quarter or so. I take it down, put in all the new data, and then put it back in. So that's an offsite safety net. True. But I've had an idea lately, and it's something that I'm going to be actively pursuing in the coming weeks. Our neighbors are close by, and my Wi-Fi signal reaches well into their yard and around the block, sort of thing. So what if I get a small little Intel NUC, NUC, next unit of computing? I forget exactly why they called it that, but they're like the size of a book. Tiny little computer, and they've got the highest grade of Wi-Fi and everything else packed into a really small package with the ability to have a 2.5-inch hard drive and USB ports and everything else on that. What if I, do a favor for my neighbor and say, hey, by the way, can you just stick this in some corner of your house? Just leave it plugged in, preferably on a wall that is close to mine. And then I can back up off-site to my neighbor's house, where I've got, maybe an 8 terabyte storage device there to keep all the good stuff kind of running and flowing there. Where if anything happens to my house and my neighbor's house, I probably have more things to worry about than the safety of my data.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, I think that's a good plan. And then that's the offsite, local offsite last mile that I'm missing. Right there. And I know some of these services, I think CrashPlan allows you to do it as well, where you can, I think with their software, you can designate a third party or a friend or family member that has decent speed internet and then co-locate a drive in a closet in their house or something, and then have the mirror happen that way.
That's cool.
Yeah, you can do that. I've never done that because frankly, I don't know how much. Yeah, I know the backup is encrypted, but still, I don't know. That's a lot of data. That's your life over there in a third party location, right?
Yeah, well, and I had issues where my internet service provider was throttling my connection to Carbonite, though Carbonite says they're not throttling it. My internet service provider is forbidden from doing so by federal government regulations from, in Canada, the CRTC. But after about a day of uploading data, my connection of 20 megabits per second all of a sudden went down to a hard ceiling of 7 megabits per second. And so getting the data into the cloud is difficult because there are so many unexpected barriers that come along. Funny enough, I know that somebody was throttling me because as soon as I connected to a VPN to Toronto, which is the nearest big city to me, my bandwidth increased to 11 megabits per second. And that should never happen. You're adding complexity and extra steps to that transmission of information. It should go down. Yeah. The fact that it went up means people were looking at what was being transferred and artificially slowing things down. So that offsite data, man, especially I've been shooting a lot of 4K video lately. And you know, I can fill up a couple of hundred gigabytes in a day. Easily. For some documentary film work. And until I get that delivered to my client, I'm at risk because I've got some amazing footage. But if something happens before I can get it to them, then an entire project for which I am just a single member of is in jeopardy.
Yeah. So yeah. Yeah, for folks that you know, for its data is your business, it makes sense to take extra precautions like that, right? And to make sure that you are bulletproof and you are redundant and you've had a 3-2-1 strategy, all this stuff. But you know, I think you could maybe afford to be less diligent if it's not mission critical type data. But at the same time, that doesn't mean, like, for example, that what you're building, probably not necessary for the folks that are, you know, just taking pictures of the kids and, you know, having fun that kind of way, that kind of thing. But they should still have a solid backup strategy for their data, you know, because you're never going to get those kids' first steps videos back again.
And another thing that I've been doing lately is on certain services like Flickr, I've been uploading almost full resolution images. And of course, these are JPEG files and everything. Mm-hmm. But if I'm posting images on a daily or weekly basis, all of my best work gets out there. If everything around me, if every option that I have completely fails, as catastrophic and as unlikely as that would be, I still have something. I still have full resolution images that are on a service like Flickr. Yeah, it's not going to be my, you know, 16-bit TIFF files that I would much prefer to print from, but as that final safety net, there's something there. And some people say, well, what if people steal your images? Eh, they're going to steal them no matter what resolution you put them up if they want them. And so there's kind of a moot point. You don't want to hurt people that are enjoying your work to prevent those thieves from just being thieves, because they're going to keep doing that anyhow.
Absolutely.
But anyhow, that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, that's a whole other show. Yeah.
Exactly. Let's move on to the final story. And this is one of those fun forward-thinking moments in photography that gets me asking what if and what the possibilities could possibly be here. Google, they got a lot of money. And they're working on a lot of experiments, just like Canon and Nikon have been. But they bought a company that you know, we talked about earlier on, Lytro. Lytro is now owned thanks to a $40 million check written by Google. It's part of that that Googleplex infrastructure now. It is the portfolio of patents, the talent, and every bit and piece of Lytro is now in the gargantuan powerhouse of Google. Wants to make something happen, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So, Frederick, I know that you were talking about this recently yourself. What do you think this means?
I'm encouraged. Well, first of all, one thing is that this was patents only and IP only. It wasn't the people. So, So the people have been given a check, and in this article, this DP reviewed article, it says, according to the same sources, some Lytro employees have already left the company, but you know, I think most of them have been invited to leave. So, I think Google just wanted the IP for whatever reasons. I think it's from, so that's sad, you know, just to see a tech company that's doing innovative stuff in the photo industry kind of go away or be absorbed into a larger organism. But at the same time, hopefully, fingers crossed, Google will do something with them. You know, they'll do something with this technology. Lytro technology, which I know you're well aware of, they use this, they actually invented and patented the idea of, it's kind of a light tracing, I think they call it light field technology.
Light field technology.
Where basically they're ray tracing, if you're familiar with 3D imaging, they're ray tracing every photon of light and its path within the scene and recording that within the image, which allows you to...
So you're not just figuring out the like where it falls, but what its trajectory
is. Yeah, where it came from.
And with that information, then you have the ability to change focus.
Yes.
Just like, and I think the Lytro Illume, which was their last consumer-facing product, would like have 16 or so different steps of focus that you could carry on through. And they produce some really high-end 6-degree of motion VR equipment that has this like massive bug's eye array of cameras all in different angles and focal lengths and everything. fun stuff, but nothing that we would ever see as a consumer.
And too niche, I think. I think, like we said on This Week in Photo last night, I think it's great. The technology was fantastic. The cameras, I think, left a lot of people wanting because they were like, wow, what do I need that for? I have these other cameras. And I think the technology itself, the IP, which I think Google was smart to buy, is just that. It's a technology. And for I would say professional photographers and even advanced amateur photographers, it was an edge case. Again, this was another one of those cures in search of a disease, right? Because every now and then, like I was saying on the show, every now and then I may take a photo that's soft for some reason. I wish I could go back and focus it, you know, or get it sharper. But that's an edge case, you know? It's not...
If that was built into your existing equipment, however, so if the next Google-branded phone that you buy has some of this light field technology just built into that camera, then that makes a lot more sense because you're not separating it out and making it a niche. You're wrapping that niche into your existing product and just, you know, giving the benefit to everybody. Yeah. So there's one great use there. But man, the gear started spinning in my head. I was thinking, well... I mean, these action cam stuff is everywhere. And Google had their Google Glass for a while. But what if you had Google Glass with stereo light field cameras in it?
Mm-hmm.
So that you could refocus after the fact and see depth information and everything else. I think that would be dramatic and very, very useful because you just put on these glasses instead of wearing... Whenever I see somebody wearing a GoPro on their helmet, it makes me think of that Canon camera that is at the beginning of our discussion here, and I'll make sure that there's a picture of it on the show notes. It's dorky, but you know, if you could wrap that into something that's a little bit more elegant or you know, less intrusive, then I think that there's some fun there. But what if? I mean, Google's been huge in the VR push, right? So, what if? You could have some sort of VR headset that could detect your eyes trying to focus on a different point. I'm sure that kind of technology exists in some way, shape, or form. And then dynamically change the optics in the VR headset to allow your eyes focusing at a different point to still focus at the exact same screen, but change the input of whatever the data is to a different focus point to make it replicate the idea of actually shifting the focus
like
of your vision.
Iris,
and creating a much more immersive VR experience because of
I
that.
I think we're heading
in
that
direction. There's a lot of possibilities.
You know, I'm eagerly awaiting Ready Player One. It's a new movie that's coming out. It's all about VR and, you know, it's a dystopian world, but it's utopian within the VR environment, right? That's basically the gist of it. But yeah, I agree. If Google was to apply light field technology to something like VR to do those kinds of things, they could lead that. Absolutely. I think one of the other uses for light field technology might be in Hollywood. If they could somehow apply light field to video, right? I think it's a lot of data, right? But to apply it to video, to every frame, where a director could go in and, you know, say they were doing a multi-million-dollar shoot that was not repeatable with explosions and all this other stuff in there, to go in later and have different perspectives of the film and then also be able to change the focal point in the editing bay, right? Versus having, you know, the cameraman focused on the hero instead of the, you know, the antagonist, and now we have to reshoot this thing. To be able to do that in the studio, that could be that's at least a sales point on a brochure, I'd say. You know?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But then again, that would hopefully be rolled into whatever camera you're already using for this broadcast footage, because Lytro, the reason why I didn't jump on board is they were low resolution. Mm-hmm. The cameras had almost no features, you know, it was just this one gimmick even the service to view these images has shut down.
Yeah.
Like if you were sharing them on Facebook and things like that, that's no longer functional. Yeah. So if we have no use of that technology now as a standalone device, its only hope is, Red rolls that into, say, their cinema cameras because that's what's being used on the set of whatever Hollywood shoot you were just mentioning. Yep. It has to be a part of the high-end gear or the gear that's with us all the time. And it'll come. I think that we are on the cusp of that. The fact that Google, being such a big company, now owns those patents are not just going to sit idly by. I've got a very good feeling that they're going to put them to use at some point very soon. So we live in interesting times as photographers, and it's constantly changing. You know, we've got artificial intelligent algorithms that are detecting certain things in photographs and redrawing things and adding keywords to images based on what it sees, and those are getting better and better as time goes on.
Yeah. It's crazy where things are going. It is completely insane. You know, every time I talk to you, Don, my brain starts spinning because it goes into what if mode, because it's like what if, like, if they did that, what if you merge this Litro light field technology with the object detection and recognition technology so that you could look at something and, you know, have it know that that's what you're looking at and detect it, you know, and say, oh, that's an apple you're looking at. Let's focus on the apple. Everything else gets blurry except the apple. And then it looks it up in the database and says, oh, this is a Macintosh apple. And this is this. And this is, you know, it gives you overlaid augmented reality data about that apple while the rest of the bokeh is blurry. And, you know, that could be cool. I want that in my life. I need that headset right now.
I want that in my life too. Now, but that doesn't change my photography, by the way.
No.
I mean, I still like to get it right in camera and not depend on, you know, whatever it would be in post-processing as a crutch. Mm-hmm. But the more tools we have, the more creative we can be. I think that's the final, putting the pin in that discussion. Yeah. But speaking of tools and the ability to be creative, I think that kind of lends us into the picks of the week section of this episode. And mine is definitely a niche, but it's one that if you don't know about, you won't be able to explore properly. And this is doing acceptably good ultraviolet reflectance photography. Ooh. And so that is letting the camera collect ultraviolet light by its very nature. And every camera, just like for infrared photography, you probably have to modify the camera as the first step to start doing this really well. And companies like LifePixel and whomever else, that they will, you know, take off the filters and let the sensor collect as much ultraviolet light as possible. But the problem is bigger with ultraviolet in that the lens will block most of the ultraviolet light. The coatings, the fancy optical coatings, or the glue that sticks multiple elements together, that will block or otherwise disallow the transmission of ultraviolet light down through the lens to the sensor. So you'd be dealing with very long, like 10 seconds to multiple minute exposures in order to get a decent ultraviolet shot. The trick then is, okay, well, do a search online for an ultraviolet lens. And they make them. There's Coastal Optics makes one, and there's a few other companies. They cost $8,000.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
Niche. You know, barrier to entry right there. It's going to stop you in your tracks. Yeah, you can modify an old camera for full spectrum photography, but you're not going to drop $8,000 on a lens. Nikon had a UV Nikkor macro lens back in the day as well. And they used quartz elements that have a higher transmission of ultraviolet light. Again, it's around the same price point for a used one. Well, I found this little lens here that is available on eBay. I'm going to put a link to it. That's a clone of the Kyoei Kuribayashi lens, which was known for its high ultraviolet transmission properties. Costs $100.
Oh, wow.
And it comes with filters that block visible and infrared light.
Wow.
So you can, with a modified camera and a $100 lens, start photographing ultraviolet light directly. And why would you want to do that? Well, insects see patterns in flowers that are invisible to us. And there's an entire world of these bullseyes and running lights to guide insects into flowers that we normally never see. And it could be a lot of fun to explore that. You know, for the cost of modifying a camera, might be a couple of $100, but you can put infrared filters in front of a lens on that and use it for multiple purposes as well. Or pick up one of these little lenses for $100 with the filters and explore an entirely new world of photography that you didn't even know existed or you thought was unattainable.
That is fantastic. That is cool. You bring up a good point that bothers me a lot, and that's the limited range of the visible light spectrum that we can perceive, right? The electromagnetic spectrum is huge, right? What does it go from? You know this, right? From infrared all the way through to radio, right? On the or X-ray.
Well, Yeah, so you'd be going into X-ray on the other end of things. But, I mean, the range that we see...
It's like this. It's tiny. It's like, yeah.
Blue light is 400 nanometers, and red light is 700 nanometers. Yeah. And that is the extent of it. And so when we're talking about taking photos in ultraviolet, that's not a huge step beyond that 400. You might be between 300 and 400 from what the camera can detect. But even adding that much extra range, there's a lot more that can be seen that is completely invisible to us.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, I always think, there could be aliens walking around right now that are only visible within a spectrum that we can't see, right? So
that is definitely an episode of Star Trek Voyager.
Exactly. Voyager or Black Mirror or Torchwood, one of those, right?
So speaking of creative approaches to photography, we talked about your pick right before we got started, and it made me realize that I heard about this and I didn't check it out, and now I absolutely have to.
Yeah, it's an app on iOS. I'm not sure if it's on Android as well, but it's called Focus, and it's spelled F-O-C-O-S, and it's all about computational photography. So let me read the description to you, because they say it better than I could. They say Focus is a big step in the future of computational photography, bringing DSLR-like photography to your dual-camera iPhone with beautiful bokeh effects, usually achievable only with professional large-aperture cameras. With the technology of computational photography, you can make unlimited changes to your photos. You can focus after the fact and change the aperture repeatedly, exceeding the limits of any editing tools you've known before. The creative potential is unleashed by Focus. So, that's a lot of hyperbole and marketing speak, but playing with the app, it's actually pretty dang cool, right? I mean, it does what it says it's going to do, and it gives you that flexibility. And I'm a huge fan of blurry backgrounds. And I have an iPhone 10 with the dual cameras and all that. So with this, you can do some really, really interesting effects that look completely convincing. Like, that's the key, because I've seen these apps before that even the, to be honest with you, not even the built-in, there's a portrait mode on iPhone 10 where...
And I have seen some colossal failures that are kind of laughably like a blooper.
Yeah, it needs the right situation in order for it to give you good results. This thing doesn't. It does much better. In fact, I think Apple should maybe buy these guys or Google or somebody. But it does what the portrait mode on the standard stock iPhone 10 does, but 150 times better. And it's beautiful. And it's beautiful. It's well designed. I'm looking at the page right now. I've already bought it, so it's not telling me how much it costs. It's not that expensive. I think it's like, literally a couple bucks. And it gives you...
We'll put the link in the show notes to that information. But at the same time, as we've been saying this whole episode, this stuff is only getting better. We mentioned in the last episode that Google just open sourced its algorithms to do object detection in frames. And I spent a lot of money on some very good lenses that create novelty bokeh, like the Meyer Optic Trioplan 100 lens, which is known for its soap bubble bokeh that creates some really wonderful out of focus effects. And while I still would prefer to do that in camera, that's very expensive, requires specialized gear and in the right scenario. And I mean, it's a manual focus, mechanical lens and all that. I mean, it's not an easy thing to use. This app, if it can achieve a similar effect, then it just brings up the question, well, do we care about the difference? Right. Some people will always care, and other people will love the convenience and are just after that feel and that look by any means necessary.
Yeah. Yep. Perfect. I agree. So that's my pick.
Thank you for that, Frederick. Finally, the last segment of the show is what the future holds for your creative endeavors. What has those creative juices flowing right now, and what are you going to put that effort into moving into the next weeks or months ahead?
Okay, so that's a really good question, because I'm excited about a lot of stuff. The main thing that I'm excited about right now is it's kind of twofold, and I was looking forward to this call because I wanted to bounce it off you and see what you thought about it. So one of the things that I see that's missing in a lot of photography these days is the storytelling aspect. Like, there's a lot of really beautiful photos out there. There's a lot of competency. There's a lot of creativity, but I don't see a lot of storytelling, to go along with the photos. That's not to say that every photo needs a story to go along with it, but wouldn't it be cool if ... right?
If an image has a story that can be told without any words, that is somewhat universally understood, that you could just look at a still frame mm-hmm. and feel a narrative come from that, that makes the image 10 times better.
Exactly. Exactly. But then what if you push it forward? So this is where I'm going with this. What if, you know, because let me back up a little bit. When I do lectures around the country or talk to people, do public speaking, one of the things that I hear from people a lot is, what should I shoot? Even on photo walks, you know, people are kind of, they have the gear, they have this, but they are lacking that last mile of, you know, what should I shoot with this? What's my thing, right? And what I've been moving increasingly towards is what I was doing back in elementary school. I used to, for fun, I was a nerd, still am, but I used to write short science fiction stories. You know, I used to have an idea and just write a story, you know, from beginning to end. So I was thinking, what if I reach back into old Frederick, pull that out and do, you know, write a short story, but then using the superpowers that I have now of photography, image making, create a narrative to go along with it, or a visual narrative to go along with it, or even an audio narrative to go along with it. So what that might manifest as, okay, here's a short story that describes some fantastical thing, right? And then here's a photo that goes along with it. Maybe it's a photo, maybe it's a cinemagraph with some sort of interesting animation in there or something. And then here's a VO track that is talking or reading the text, or otherwise right. talking about, or some combination of that, where you're, you know, I call it, you know, I coined the phrase on TWIP called multimediography. It's kind of that, where you bring multimedia, mini media, you know, like text and audio and video and cinemagraphs and all these things together into one final piece that tells a story. And then you could zoom out from that and make it episodic, where, you know, if I wrote a short story that's maybe four chapters long, I could do a piece for chapter one, then chapter two, chapter three, chapter four, and then release them, you know, as we go along. So that's kind of what I'm thinking.
That would be a lot of fun. And yeah. I could, I, like you said, you could do it as stills, you could do it as video. Mm-hmm. You can make it immersive in different ways, accompanying text or some sort of soundtrack.
Yeah.
Even just animating a still with a couple of frames different here and there, that could be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it could be. And Apple recently updated the podcasting spec, at least for iTunes, where they added a different format of podcasts. Like the normal podcast that I think you use and that I use is, it's kind of an ongoing, I call it like TWIP, I call it an ongoing toilet paper roll. It's never ending, right? So yep. You're just going to keep going in perpetuity. They added a new serial format where you can do finite chapters of episodes.
Oh, cool.
Right? So now you can do storytelling and it's not an ongoing thing. You can do finite little stories over time, and then it ends, and you can do like, okay, this is season one, or you could do this is book one or chapter one, whatever you want to do. So I want to use that to deliver this thing that I'm working on. That's just a personal project.
Well, you know, those personal projects are what keep us enthralled with the work that we do. You know, I'm working on one right now where I'm going to be building small macro scale sets using some mineral samples of aquamarine or emeralds or fluorite or, you know, whatever it happens to be that is kind of semi-transparent that I can backlight and make it look like it's glowing, mm-hmm. but surround it by organic material, flowers and plants and vines and insects that are like a fairy landscape kind of environment mm-hmm. That will tell a narrative, right? And it's not a real narrative. It's a science fiction kind of, just like you were saying. Yeah. So this is on, I'm glad our minds are kind of in sync on this, totally. But it's on a smaller scale. And with the experiments that I've done with ultraviolet fluorescence, there's a lot of fluorescing minerals too.
Yeah.
And so imagine if I could plant like a small ant in the middle of these, what looks to be giant glowing yellow boulders and have it kind of exploring along that. I think it would be a lot of fun to create a series of images like that. Yeah. And totally. I'm gearing up. I am waiting for spring. My snowflake series is just about to end. I've got two more that I need to post. But even the one that I posted yesterday as we're recording this, it has color patterns on the surface of the snowflake from thin film interference. And if you know what thin film interference, you know, the color and exactly where the pattern is happening, you can tell the thickness of something. And so I wrote in the narrative of that post that I could tell exactly that the thickness of that snowflake shifts in an inner circle by 200 nanometers, which is 1/5000th of a millimeter.
Wow.
And you know, you can measure this by seeing what color it becomes as it goes through that transition. I write about a page of text for every one of those snowflake images that I post, mm-hmm. and I am shocked at the number of people in this too long didn't read world that actually go through and read that and comment on it. Because that is part of the narrative. It's part of the story moving forward.
Yeah, and I think that the narrative aspect of all this stuff is what's missing in a lot of photography, or even, you know, multimediaography or image making these days. Because there's you know, if you take the idea that I'm talking about, where it's science fiction or short stories or whatever, but you can also apply that to current events and do something, you know, kind of slightly to the left of reality and build something around current events with a narrative and a visual aspect to it. You know, it applies to many, many things where people can get things out of it. And we have the delivery mechanisms now, right? I mean, you can do looping animation on Instagram and put a body of text in there. You could do looping animations on Facebook if you want, if you're still using Facebook, and and go in that direction. There's so much you can do beyond just taking a photo and putting it up and waiting for the likes.
Well, that should hopefully inspire people listening to come up with some other crazy ideas that, you know, personal projects are why I am a photographer. Yes, I make money at certain things. But these personal projects where I'm allowed to just freely experiment and explore ideas, mm-hmm. I think every photographer needs to do that. And the more obscure and off the beaten path they are, then not only the more they'll mean to you, but the more they'll stand out if you ever decide to share them with the world.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, on that note, I guess we should let everybody go. And, you know, I guess our sign off here is to go get out and shoot.